A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. I said, or maybe I should say I forewarned, that I had a few more prompts to send in about the post-gallbladder surgery stuff. It's something I've been struggling with for a number, quite a long time. And I think with the AI aspect, AI is not clearly going to create a magical solution for people's long-term health problems overnight. But I do think it can be a very useful way at chipping away at problems that seem really intractable and finding solutions. And I'm definitely in that kind of phase. It's been 7 years since I had a surgery that I think, like most people who have this surgery, are told, oh, it's no big deal. You don't need your gallbladder. You'll go back to your regular diet in a few days. I'm sure plenty of people do have that experience. For me and for not a tiny minority of people, we really struggle with what feels like just a totally changed digestion. I can tell you all about the lovely details of my problems. If you don't have lunch ordered, but I can summarize them as saying it really feels like my whole GI tract or system has gone from being fine, like something that worked except for the odd kind of weird pain, which is why I had the surgery, to something that kind of honestly feels like it's fundamentally broken. Something's gone really wrong with it. It's like the motility. And the most troublesome one I have, I'd say. Fatty food definitely causes problems. You can avoid that. But I get this awful bloating after I eat or drink almost anything, including water. It's like, I think at the moment I'm getting in shape. I'm beginning to feel fairly trim. But I can go from looking at myself in the mirror thinking, oh, you're shaping up, you're losing some weight, to I have this beer belly thing, paunch, that just, you know, for after I eat, after I drink, and it's really exaggerated. Like, I look pregnant. It's gross. I feel gross. And when I began thinking about looking into all these potential things like vagal nerve implication, especially in gastrosurgeries, I think it's a possibility. I began realizing that if just drinking water triggers these symptoms sometimes, then it's not necessarily a nutrient thing, because what's in water, right? It's just tap water. I began looking into this, and it's been a while since I checked out these online support spaces, but I was for a while looking in, you know, in concert with seeing a doctor, a gastroenterologist, just finding these communities and seeing what people were with similar symptoms were doing. And I noticed that this particular problem with water seemed to be actually quite common, and no one seemed to understand what even the potential cause was. In particular, two groups, functional dyspepsia, which is definitely something that applies in my case, and gastroparesis, which I don't have, but also involves nerve, the actual function breaking down as opposed to the organic problems with your system, the very poor explanation of the condition, but they often reported the same thing. Things that you'd think might provoke this very uncomfortable bloating, like soda or coffee might be less bothersome, and water being the worst, and it doesn't seem to make any sense. When I was looking at these groups, people were trying to figure this out, and we mentioned in a previous episode some kind of hacks or workarounds, like cucumber, eating veg that has a high water content, and icicles is another one that people use. But you know, if you're struggling to get hydration, and you become a lot less picky as to how it comes. So these are all things people used. Another one, and this is what I'd like to talk about today, was trying to figure out what is it that makes water feel like it just doesn't go down. I would describe, here's what it feels like to me, and I don't know if this bears any correlation to what's actually happening on the inside. I'll drink water. Pre-surgery, I didn't feel anything. Great, I love having water. Post-surgery, I get bloated, and I feel like it's just not moving. It's a really hard thing to describe, but it's a sensation that it's like literally sloshing around in your system, and that something is like blocking it or whatever. Again, whether that's just the sensation or actually bears correlation to the what's actually happening, I don't know, but that's what it feels like. People looked into cold room temperature water. Some people said that cold water is to be avoided if this is something you get. That's the first question, specific question I have for you. And question number two, and I think this might be a more promising line for us to look into, is a lot of folks had a success with electrolytes in particular. That was a common recommendation that people said they just couldn't talk. They, you know, a lot of people also had this begin after a surgery, whether gallbladder surgery or some other surgery in that area. And a lot of folks sweared by electrolyte water. And I've given it a try a few times, probably because they only come in these really small packs. I mightn't have given it a fair enough shot, but I felt like it was kind of helping. But I'm not sure if there's any. Is there any evidence for that? And regarding electrolytes, I guess what I was concerned, what maybe made me hesitate was without checking these things with a doctor. I know that might sound stupid, but I didn't want to just be ingesting in my desperate attempts to be able to drink water that's comfortable, end up taking in a huge amount of these minerals, which I know can be, you know, nothing in excess, basically. The other thing, while we're talking about the practicalities of this strategy, is electrolyte tablets sold in the pharmacy. As I mentioned, here in Israel, like everything else, tend to be super expensive, sold in small quantities, and often actually have a lot of sugar additives and be quite unhealthy. And a lot of people also develop recipes for their own homemade electrolyte drinks. A shout out to my friend Mike, who made or produced, I believe he actually ordered a very specific one from the internet, whose name I forget, but it was great, really delicious. And I'm wondering, firstly, before we get too excited about potential options, what does the science say for people in my boat, gastro, functional dyspepsia, functional disorders, who are frustrated and perplexed by this feeling that they can't drink water normally anymore, but they, of course, essential to stay hydrated. Why might this happen? But what are the, are there any explanations for the different potential options as to how you consume your water that might actually provide pointers for what can work for people and get us back to a point where we can at least tolerate water again without looking like we are about to give birth? Herman and Corin, over to you.
Daniel sent us this one. He's 7 years out from gallbladder surgery, and like a lot of people in that boat, water has become weirdly hostile. Drinking plain water makes him bloat up like he swallowed a beach ball, and he's noticed this same pattern popping up in functional dyspepsia and post-surgical communities everywhere. The core question is, why would water, of all things, be the worst offender? And second, there's this persistent anecdote that electrolyte drinks help. People swear by them. But is there actual science behind that? And can you do it without buying overpriced sugary tablets from the pharmacy?
This is one of those problems where the surface makes zero sense and the mechanism, once you see it, is actually kind of elegant. Water being the worst trigger, it feels like the universe is trolling you. But there's a physiological reason, and it starts with something called gastric accommodation, the stomach's ability to relax and expand when stuff enters it. Think of it like a balloon that's supposed to inflate smoothly. After upper abdominal surgery, any surgery that involves cutting near the stomach, the duodenum, the hepatobiliary area. The vagus nerve can get nicked, stretched, or just traumatized. The vagus nerve is what tells the stomach to relax. If that signaling is impaired, your stomach doesn't accommodate properly. Pressure goes up instead of volume expanding.
It's not about what's in the water. It's about the stomach's mechanical response to anything entering it.
And here's where water becomes the worst-case scenario. When you drink a glass of water, it hits the stomach fast and all at once. There's no buffering, no gradual release. If your gastric accommodation reflex is damaged, that bolus of water is just sitting there under tension. The stomach walls are tight, the pressure is high, and you get that sensation of it not moving, that sloshing, blocked feeling.
Which matches what he described almost word for word. It feels like it's not moving, like something is blocking it.
That's impaired gastric accommodation and possibly some degree of antral hypomotility. The lower part of the stomach isn't churning and pushing things through at the normal rate. Now, why would soda or coffee sometimes be less bothersome? That seems backwards.
Right, because carbonation and caffeine are supposed to be irritants.
Carbonation triggers the belch reflex. It introduces gas that wants to exit upward and that actually can relieve pressure. Coffee is acidic and stimulates gastrin release, which promotes motility. It gets things moving. So counterintuitively, the harsh beverages can provoke a response that water doesn't. Water just sits there, inert, waiting for a motility signal that may never arrive properly.
The blandest possible input becomes the most problematic. There's something almost darkly comic about that.
It's the digestive equivalent of a stalled car. You'd rather have a sputtering engine than one that doesn't turn over at all. There's a paper from the journal Neurogastroenterology and Motility, this was a few years back, that looked at post-cholecystectomy patients and found about 30-40% report new or worsened dyspeptic symptoms, with bloating being the most common. And a subset of those patients, when they did gastric barostat testing, showed clear impairment in gastric accommodation. They insert a balloon into the stomach and measure pressure-volume relationships. It's the gold standard for assessing gastric accommodation. And in patients with post-surgical functional dyspepsia, you often see a flat compliance curve. The stomach doesn't give. It's like trying to fill a leather pouch instead of a balloon.
That's an image. So the vagus nerve damage, how confident are we that this is the mechanism? Because surgery is blunt. They're not doing microsurgery on nerves. They're in there to get the gallbladder out.
It's not always direct nerve damage. Sometimes it's just inflammation. The gallbladder sits right next to the duodenum, and the surgery involves clipping and cauterizing in close proximity to branches of the vagus nerve, especially the hepatic branch and the anterior vagal trunk. Even if the nerve isn't severed, post-surgical inflammation can cause a functional palsy that persists for months or years, and in some people, the nerve doesn't fully recover.
We've got a plausible mechanism for why water causes bloating. Now, the electrolyte question. People in these communities say electrolyte water helps. Is that placebo, or is something actually different when you add sodium and potassium to the water?
There are at least two mechanisms that could make electrolytes genuinely helpful, and they're not the same mechanism. The first is gastric emptying. The stomach doesn't just dump everything into the small intestine indiscriminately, it regulates emptying based on the osmolarity and caloric content of what's in it. Plain water is hypotonic. It actually empties from the stomach relatively slowly compared to isotonic fluids.
I'd have assumed water just flushes right through.
That's the intuitive assumption, and it's wrong. The duodenum has osmoreceptors that detect the concentration of what's arriving. If something too hypotonic hits the duodenum, it can actually trigger a feedback mechanism that slows gastric emptying to protect the small intestine from a sudden osmotic shift. An isotonic electrolyte solution, one that matches the body's own osmolarity, can empty faster and more smoothly.
The electrolytes aren't doing something magical. They're just making the water isotonic, which the stomach processes more efficiently.
That's one piece. The second mechanism is more directly relevant to the vagus nerve problem, sodium and glucose together. And many electrolyte formulations include a small amount of glucose, activate the sodium-glucose cotransporter in the small intestine. That cotransporter actively pulls water across the intestinal epithelium through osmosis. It's the same principle behind oral rehydration therapy, which has saved millions of lives in cholera outbreaks.
Oral rehydration therapy, the WHO formula.
And this is a well-understood, deeply studied physiological pathway. When you have impaired gastric accommodation, anything that helps fluid move efficiently through the stomach and get absorbed quickly in the small intestine is going to reduce that sensation of fluid just sitting there. Electrolytes with a bit of glucose accelerate the entire transit and absorption process.
You're getting the water out of the stomach faster and into the bloodstream faster. Less sloshing, less bloating.
There's a third factor that's more speculative but worth mentioning. Some of these patients may have subclinical bile acid malabsorption. After gallbladder removal, bile is no longer stored and concentrated. It just drips continuously into the small intestine. That can irritate the intestinal lining and alter fluid handling. Electrolytes might help by supporting the intestinal barrier function and maintaining proper fluid balance in the face of that irritation.
The anecdotal reports. People saying, I tried electrolyte water, and suddenly I could hydrate without feeling terrible. That's not woo. There's actual physiology under it.
It's not woo at all. It's osmolarity, active transport, and gastric accommodation physics.
Which brings us to the practical question. If you want to try this, do you need to buy the expensive pharmacy tablets? And is there a risk of overdoing electrolytes?
Let's take the safety question first, because it's reasonable. If you have normal kidney function, the risk of overdoing electrolytes from drinking a liter or two of properly mixed electrolyte water per day is essentially zero. Your kidneys are exceptionally good at excreting excess sodium and potassium within normal ranges. The caveat is, if someone has kidney disease, heart failure, or is on potassium-sparing diuretics, those people need to check with their doctor. But for an otherwise healthy person, the amounts we're talking about are trivial compared to what the body handles daily.
The "I don't want to accidentally overdose on minerals" fear is mostly unfounded.
For the typical person, yes. The bigger concern with commercial electrolyte tablets is actually what he mentioned. They're often loaded with sugar, artificial sweeteners, and cost a fortune for what's essentially salt and potassium with some flavoring. You can make an effective homemade version for pennies.
I believe you've got a formula.
It's based directly on the World Health Organization Oral Rehydration Solution formula, scaled down for maintenance hydration rather than acute dehydration. Per liter of water, 1/4 teaspoon of regular table salt, that's sodium chloride. 1/8 teaspoon of potassium chloride, which you can get as light salt or salt substitute at any grocery store, and about 1 teaspoon of sugar. The sugar isn't for flavor, it's functional. You need that glucose to activate the sodium-glucose co-transport mechanism.
1 teaspoon of sugar in a liter of water is basically nothing. We're not making soda here.
It's about 4 grams of sugar per liter. A can of Coke has about 39 grams. This is functionally sugar-free from a dietary perspective, but it's enough to drive the co-transporter. If you want to skip the sugar entirely, you can. The isotonic benefit still applies, but the absorption efficiency is measurably better with that small amount of glucose.
What about taste?
Like very slightly salty water. It's not delicious, but it's not offensive either. A squeeze of lemon or a splash of lime juice helps enormously, and citrus doesn't seem to trigger the bloating response in most people the way plain water does. Some folks use a pinch of magnesium citrate powder too, but that can have a laxative effect, so I'd start without it.
The cost comparison.
Commercial electrolyte tablets here in Israel, as he noted, run about 2 to 3 shekels per tablet, and you need 1 or 2 per liter. The homemade version costs maybe 10 agarot per liter, if that. Salt and potassium chloride are commodity items. The markup on electrolyte products is absurd.
We've got a mechanism for why water hurts, a mechanism for why electrolytes help, and a practical recipe that costs almost nothing. That feels like a satisfying answer. But I want to drill into the temperature thing, because he mentioned that cold water versus room temperature water came up in these communities, with some people saying cold water is worse.
This one has less hard literature behind it, but the physiology makes sense. Cold fluids can trigger a reflex called the gastrocolic reflex, the stomach detecting cold and signaling the colon to contract. In someone with a sensitized gut, that can translate to cramping and bloating. Cold can also cause vasoconstriction locally in the gastric mucosa and may slow gastric emptying slightly. There's also a sensory component. Cold receptors in the stomach wall may amplify the sensation of distension.
It's not that cold water is chemically different. It's that the temperature itself triggers reflexes that a dysregulated system handles poorly.
This is where the functional dyspepsia piece becomes really important. Functional dyspepsia is characterized by visceral hypersensitivity. The nerves in the gut are overinterpreting normal stimuli as painful or uncomfortable. If your nervous system is already in a heightened state, a temperature stimulus that a normal stomach would barely register can feel intensely uncomfortable. It's the same reason some people with FD find that room temperature everything is safer. They're minimizing sensory input to a system that's over-amplifying everything.
Which also explains the ice chip's workaround. You're taking in tiny amounts of cold, not a full glass, so the sensory load is spread out and the stomach isn't hit with a large cold bolus all at once.
And cucumber, high water content vegetables, same principle. You're getting hydration, but it's bound up in fiber and arriving slowly, giving the stomach time to accommodate. It's the rate of fluid delivery that matters as much as the fluid itself.
The unifying theme across all these workarounds, electrolytes, room temperature, ice chips, cucumber, is reducing the instantaneous demand on a stomach that can't relax properly.
That's the through line. Impaired accommodation means the stomach can't handle volume surges. Every effective workaround either reduces the volume per swallow, speeds up emptying, or reduces the sensory triggers. Once you understand the mechanism, all the weird scattered anecdotes suddenly make sense as different strategies for the same underlying problem.
The body's revenge for losing its gallbladder is becoming deeply weird about unavoidable things. We talked about that before. The cruelty of the thing you need most becoming the thing that hurts you. You can't negotiate with water.
You can't. And that's what makes this particular symptom so psychologically wearing. If it were just fatty foods, you can avoid those. If it were just coffee, you can quit coffee. But you have to drink water multiple times a day, every day, forever. Having each drink be uncomfortable is a slow grind on your quality of life.
The medical system doesn't handle this well. You go to a gastroenterologist and say, "Water makes me bloat," and they look at you like you've grown a second head. Then they prescribe a proton pump inhibitor and send you home.
Because the diagnostic framework for functional disorders is still underdeveloped. Functional dyspepsia is a diagnosis of exclusion. You get scoped, they find nothing structurally wrong, and you get the FD label. But FD itself is a bucket that contains multiple distinct pathophysiologies. Impaired accommodation, visceral hypersensitivity, delayed emptying, duodenal eosinophilia. Until recently, there wasn't even a standard way to test for impaired accommodation outside of research settings.
Patients are left to figure it out themselves on Reddit and Facebook groups.
Which is simultaneously depressing and kind of remarkable. These communities have become de facto clinical trial networks. Someone tries electrolytes, reports back, others replicate, patterns emerge. It's messy and uncontrolled, but it's producing actionable knowledge faster than the formal research pipeline.
The distributed science of desperate people.
I'd frame it more generously. It's experiential evidence filling a gap that the medical establishment hasn't addressed. And when the experiential evidence lines up with known physiology, which it does here, that's worth paying attention to.
Let's talk about the bile acid piece you mentioned earlier. Post-cholecystectomy, bile is just dripping continuously. What does that actually do to the system over time?
This is one of the underappreciated consequences of gallbladder removal. The gallbladder isn't just a storage pouch, it concentrates bile and releases it in timed pulses coordinated with meals. Without it, bile trickles into the duodenum continuously. Between meals, that bile can pool in the small intestine and even reflux back into the stomach.
Bile in the stomach.
Bile is alkaline, not acidic, but it's still a detergent. It breaks down fats by emulsifying them. When it sits in contact with the gastric mucosa, it can cause chemical gastritis. It disrupts the mucus layer that protects the stomach lining. And it can alter the motor function of the stomach and small intestine. There's a condition called bile reflux gastropathy that's recognized but probably underdiagnosed in post-cholecystectomy patients.
That would compound the accommodation problem. You got a stomach that can't relax properly, and now the lining is being irritated by bile.
And bile acids in the colon draw water into the bowel. That's one mechanism of post-cholecystectomy diarrhea. But even at subdiarrheal levels, bile acids can alter fluid handling throughout the GI tract, contributing to that sensation of things not moving right.
Is there anything that binds bile acids that could help?
Bile acid sequestrants like cholestyramine exist, but they're prescription medications and they're not exactly pleasant to take. They're gritty powders that can cause constipation and interfere with fat-soluble vitamin absorption. For someone whose primary symptom is bloating rather than diarrhea, I wouldn't jump to that. The electrolyte approach is lower risk and addresses the symptom more directly.
What about the timing of drinking? We've talked about what you drink and the temperature, but when you drink relative to meals, does that matter?
It can, and this is a practical tip that's often overlooked. Drinking a large volume of fluid with a meal further distends a stomach that's already struggling to accommodate food. For someone with impaired accommodation, separating drinking from eating, hydrating between meals rather than during them, can reduce the total volume load on the stomach at any one time.
You eat your meal, wait 30 to 45 minutes, then drink. Or drink first, wait, then eat.
And if you're using the electrolyte solution, you can sip it slowly throughout the day rather than chugging a full glass at once. Small, frequent sips of an isotonic fluid, that's probably the gentlest possible hydration strategy for this condition.
Small sips of slightly salty water, room temperature, between meals. This is the glamorous life of the post-gallbladder patient.
It's not glamorous, but it can be the difference between feeling terrible all day and feeling mostly normal. And most people adapt to the taste and routine pretty quickly.
Let's circle back to something he mentioned that we haven't addressed, the online communities themselves. He said he noticed this pattern across functional dyspepsia groups and gastroparesis groups, water being the worst trigger. That's a striking pattern, because those are different diagnoses.
They are, but they share a common feature, impaired gastric motor function and/or visceral hypersensitivity. Gastroparesis is delayed gastric emptying, often from vagus nerve damage. Functional dyspepsia can involve impaired accommodation, which is also vagally mediated, so it's not surprising that the same symptom clusters appear across both conditions. The underlying pathophysiology overlaps.
The fact that no one in these communities knew the mechanism, they just knew it was happening. That's a failure of medical communication, not a failure of observation.
These patients are reporting a real, reproducible phenomenon. The fact that most gastroenterologists couldn't explain it doesn't make it psychosomatic. It makes it understudied.
There's a broader point here about post-surgical care, or the lack of it. You have an organ removed, you're told you'll be fine, and then when you're not fine, there's no protocol. It's, well, the surgery was successful. The gallbladder is out. Good luck.
The technical term is surgical success, but functional failure. The operation achieves its anatomical goal. The diseased organ is removed, but the patient's functional outcome is poor. And the gap between surgical success and patient satisfaction is huge in gallbladder surgery. Some studies put the rate of persistent post-cholecystectomy symptoms at anywhere from 10 to 40%, depending on how you measure and what symptoms you count.
10 to 40% is not a rounding error. That's millions of people.
Most of them are navigating this alone, or with doctors who have nothing to offer beyond avoid trigger foods and try a PPI. The fact that a homemade electrolyte drink, salt, potassium, sugar, water, could meaningfully improve quality of life for a subset of these patients, and yet it's not standard advice, is a quiet indictment of how we handle post-surgical functional disorders.
It's also a testament to how something can be simultaneously simple and invisible. The ingredients are in every kitchen. The mechanism is first-year physiology. But nobody connects the dots because the system isn't looking.
The system isn't looking because functional disorders don't show up on a scope. If you can't see it, it's harder to study, harder to fund, harder to treat. The bias toward structural pathology is deep.
If someone's listening to this and thinking, that's me, water makes me bloat, I'm 7 years out from surgery and nobody told me any of this, what's the practical takeaway?
Start with the homemade electrolyte solution. 1 liter of water, 1/4 teaspoon salt, 1/8 teaspoon potassium chloride, 1/1 teaspoon sugar. Sip it slowly between meals rather than with meals. Give it a week. If it helps, you've got a cheap, safe, sustainable hydration strategy. If it doesn't, you've lost nothing but the cost of some salt.
The sugar. People are going to hear sugar and get nervous. Reiterate why it's there and how little it is.
It's 1 teaspoon per liter. That's 4 grams of sugar. For context, a medium apple has about 19 grams of sugar. The sugar is there because the sodium glucose cotransporter in your small intestine requires both sodium and glucose to activate. When it activates, it pulls water across the intestinal wall and into your bloodstream. Without that small amount of glucose, you still get the isotonic benefit, but the active transport advantage is reduced. It's not about calories or sweetness, it's a molecular key that unlocks a specific absorption pathway.
If you're diabetic or watching blood sugar,
4 grams of sugar is well within the margin of error for blood glucose management. It's less than the sugar in a stick of sugar-free gum. But if someone has concerns, they can try it without the sugar first and see if the isotonic effect alone is sufficient.
What about the cold versus room temperature piece? Is there a practical recommendation there?
If cold water triggers symptoms, let the water come to room temperature. If room temperature is still problematic, try it slightly warm, not hot, just body temperature or a bit above. The goal is to find the temperature that creates the least sensory disturbance. For most people with this issue, room temperature is the sweet spot.
The ice chips and cucumber strategies. Those are valid alternatives, if even the electrolyte solution is problematic.
Ice chips provide tiny volumes that don't challenge gastric accommodation. Cucumber and other high-water vegetables like watermelon deliver water bound in a matrix that releases slowly. These are workarounds, not solutions, but they work for the same reason the electrolyte approach works. They reduce the instantaneous volume load.
It strikes me that all of this, the electrolytes, the temperature, the timing, the ice chips, is essentially a manual override of a system that's supposed to run automatically. Your stomach used to handle all this without you thinking about it. Now you're the system administrator.
That's exactly what it is, and that's exhausting. The cognitive load of managing basic hydration is not trivial. It's one of those invisible burdens of chronic illness that healthy people never have to think about.
Which is why having a simple, cheap protocol that works is so valuable. It reduces the cognitive load. You mix up a bottle in the morning, you sip it through the day, you don't have to constantly make micro decisions about what and how to drink.
Once you find a protocol that works, you can stop thinking about hydration entirely. That's the real goal, not just tolerating water, but getting back to the point where drinking is automatic and unremarkable.
The dream of boring hydration.
It sounds absurd, but yes. The dream is that water becomes boring again.
I want to touch on one more thing before we wrap. He mentioned that this problem seems to have a vagal nerve implication, and he's right to think that. But the vagus nerve is having a moment in popular science right now. Cold plunges, breathwork, hacking the vagus nerve. Is any of that relevant here, or is that a distraction?
It's mostly a distraction. The vagus nerve is not one thing. It's a complex bundle of fibers that innervates everything from the larynx to the colon. The branches that control gastric accommodation are not the same branches that are stimulated by dunking your face in cold water. The vagal tone that wellness influencers talk about is primarily about the parasympathetic regulation of heart rate, which is mediated by different vagal fibers. Damaged vagal branches in the upper abdomen don't get better because you did some deep breathing.
If someone tells you to fix your post-surgical bloating with cold plunges, smile and walk away.
Smile, walk away, and go mix yourself some electrolyte water.
So to land this, the water bloating problem is real. It's not in your head. It's likely driven by impaired gastric accommodation from vagus nerve trauma or inflammation during surgery. Plain water is the worst trigger because it's hypotonic and hits the stomach as a bolus, challenging a stomach that can't relax. Electrolytes help by making the solution isotonic and activating active transport pathways that speed absorption. Cold can exacerbate symptoms through sensory reflexes. The fix is cheap, safe, and doesn't require a prescription.
That's the summary. And for anyone who's been dealing with this for years without answers, I hope it helps. Sometimes the problem isn't that there's no solution. It's that nobody bothered to connect the dots between the physiology and the lived experience.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
A 16th century Portuguese manuscript on arithmetic, cataloged in São Tomé and Príncipe, describes a counting board using polished coconut shell counters instead of beads or stones. The scribe notes with evident frustration that they skitter across the board at the slightest breeze.
The mental image of a colonial accountant chasing coconut shells across a desk is, honestly, it's doing something for me.
That's a design flaw you only document once.
The open question I keep coming back to is this. If the mechanism for post-cholecystectomy water intolerance is fairly straightforward physiology, why isn't this standard post-surgical counseling? Why are patients still being told you'll be fine and sent home to discover on their own that water hurts?
Because surgical follow-up is structured around complications, infection, bile leak, retained stones, not functional outcomes. The surgeon's job ends when the wound heals. What happens after that, in the domain of daily symptoms and quality of life, falls into a gap between surgery and gastroenterology that nobody owns.
That gap is where people spend years on forums, trying cucumber and ice chips, figuring out what the medical system should have told them on day one.
It shouldn't take a podcast and a homemade salt recipe to solve a problem this common. But until the system catches up, the information is out there. And now, it's a little more connected to the physiology that explains why it works.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for keeping this show running, and thanks to everyone who shared their experiences with post-surgical problems. You're not crazy, and you're not alone.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if this episode helped you, leave us a review. It's how more people find the show.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back with more Weird Prompts soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.